Welcome to the Once Upon a Leader in Africa podcast with George Nudu. We invite you to listen to influencers and opinion shapers narrating their experiences from their leadership roles in Africa, from the world of business, community development, government, corporate, social enterprise, among others. We will glean from their good, bad, and ugly side of their leadership journey and be inspired to overcome adversity, to pursue success against all odds, to be a great leader, and many other lessons. Welcome to the podcast, and here's George Nudu.
Hello, Martin. How are you?
I'm fine, George. Very fine. Thank you. Glad it's the end of the week, so I'm looking forward to a couple of days of rest.
Great, great. Wonderful. Thank you so much for taking time to just for us to have this conversation about your leadership journey. And welcome to the podcast.
Yeah. Welcome. And thank you so much to you as well for, one, considering me, and two, availing time for us to have a chat. It's a very interesting topic of choice and something I'm looking forward to.
So, Martin, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I don't know if that's possible, the little bit part, because it's a question I answer frequently, and sometimes I struggle with, because you don't know where to start and where to stop. And so maybe for purposes of giving you a summary, it would be nice to just give you a short synopsis. So my name is Martin Ochieng. I'm the current Group Managing Director and CEO at Sasini PLC. Sasini is East Africa's premier agricultural business, and we're involved in the growing, processing, packing, marketing, and exporting of tea, coffee, macadamia, and avocado to markets as far east as Japan and South Korea, and the US and Canada in the West, and pretty much everything in between. So depending on which product you're talking about, we market and export those to customers from a business to business perspective in different parts of the world. So our coffee goes to Japan, South Korea in the East, but mainly to the US. At about 40% of our volume goes to the US, to go in some very popular brands that I'm sure you're familiar with. And our tea principally goes to Pakistan and the UK. So those two markets take about 80% of the volume we make. The balance of it goes into smaller markets here and there, led by Egypt. Our avocado fruit goes in full fruit to Central Europe, so to Germany, Holland, France, and the UK. And our macadamia nuts principally are sold to the United States. And so, as you can see, we are a truly global business. And I like saying to people that we are this Kenyan company that feeds the world. But that's what I do now. And my background is littered in a nice way, in a blessed way, if you ask me, with several experiences coming out of going to school here in Kenya and going to college here, joining the global, commercial trade in the pharmaceutical industry in the early 90s, and with a company called 3M. 3M is, to date, probably one of the top three most diversified businesses in the world. 3M had, when I worked there, a pharmaceutical arm called 3M Healthcare, and I started my journey there in the business world of pharmaceutical salesmanship and marketing, and then moved to Pfizer, another sort of like, at the time, American conglomerate in the pharma industry. You would know them from their recent fame with the vaccines on COVID. So I worked there, in fact, for a solid 15, 16 years, a very, very good part of my career, and grew there immensely, going to different parts, being responsible for different geographies on the continent, in Asia, in Europe, and gained tremendously from my time there, and lived in several different countries as a result of that work. And then I led them towards the back end of the, the first decade of the new millennium to go to a South African outfit called KWV International. And at KWV, I was head of global marketing. KWV was a wines and spirits business, one of the top two South African wines and spirits businesses. And we had business in 64 countries globally. And I was leading the charge there from a strategy and global marketing perspective. It was a very, very interesting journey. And eventually, 5 years into that job, I got an unpassable opportunity in another company, American, called Tyco International. Tyco at the time, TYCO is spelled, at the time was the world's biggest fire and security business, and still is, though they merged with Johnson Controls a few years ago, and so continues to be a big player in the systems and fire and access control area. All that meant that I spent a couple of decades in South Africa doing a few of those jobs, and I came back home sometime in 2018. And in 2019, I joined Sasini for my current role. So, in fact, last week I celebrated 5 years at Sasini. It's gone so quickly that sometimes you wonder whether it's really 5 years or it's been just 5 weeks.
Wow, congrats. Congrats on those 5 years. Wow,
Thank
you've
you.
had quite a global experience in your leadership. Just looking back, what was the genesis, or where was the genesis of your leadership journey?
To be honest, George, I've looked back and it doesn't surprise me that question, because I've always asked myself, was this something inherent or was it something learned? And I think it's a little bit of both. When I was in primary school, I had a few leadership roles, and it was in the sporting space. I went to school in the 80s, in the early 80s, in primary school, and I went to a school which was very active in hockey, in field hockey. And I started playing for the school team when I was in the fifth level of primary school. And by the time I was in standard six, I was captain of that team. I was one of the smallest players in the team, but I think sort of like being swift and good enough in hockey gave me that leadership role. It really is the only leadership role that I was given in primary school. I was never really a prefect or a class leader, though I had a leadership role academically as well. I guess I don't know whether you'd call that leadership, but just sort of like being top of your class or being top of certain subjects that that we did at the time. And then going to high school, my 6 years of secondary and advanced level studies, I eventually became a prefect and a captain, which in the school I went to was a prestigious thing to be bestowed with. And I think that probably points to the very first sort of like inclinations that there was some skill in me that people saw, that they thought, this guy could be used to lead others. And then, George, unfortunately, when I was in the university in 1991, I lost my father. And being the firstborn in a family of four siblings, left with three sisters and my mom, I was thrown into the, deep end of sort of like stepping into dad's shoes. And mom did that so expertly, but I didn't realize it at the time, but it was just sort of like every decision she made from that time on involved me or my opinion or my involvement somehow in driving those decisions going forward. So I would say those were the genesis, well and long before I joined the corporate world.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I keep hearing this over and over again, how leadership started at home and in school. And it's amazing. It's true. It just starts from there. So for you, you've had such a global experience in leading the various positions you've talked about. And as you look at your leadership style, how would you describe it?
It's changed. If you asked me this question 30 years ago, I would give you a very different answer. I was young, a little bit forward, so I thought I knew everything. And my style then was I lead, others follow. That's why I have the position, If you then fast forward to maybe 15 years ago, from the time I started my leadership journey in the corporate space, it was morphing into more of a softer approach of listening or being open to other people's ideas and not just thinking that you are the one with all the ideas and all the answers. If you look at that journey today, my leadership style is very different, and it's dependent on what issue I'm being asked to lead. So I don't have a dominant style. I have very different styles that fit into different situations. And so there are times where I need to lead from the front because I need to give direction. I need to be the one saying, this is what we're going to do. And there are times where I lead from the middle. I let other people lead, and or I lead with people. in a concept I really prefer called co-leadership. And so I have other co-leaders who help me to sort of like drive the aspect that I'm leading. And then there are times, and I increasingly these are becoming more frequent, where I allow other people to lead me. And so I sit back, and if it's a space where somebody knows more than I do or is better than I am in leading that situation, then I allow them to lead that. And so it really is a mixed bag. But if you were to ask me to describe it with one word, I would say it's open, very open. I do not pretend to know everything. In fact, I know very little, and I walk into rooms where people expect me to sit in a corner somewhere or at the head of the table and give direction. And I always am sort of like, I want to sit with the people and say, I'm just one of us. Let's tackle this issue together. And so I've found that that allows me to let other people, you know, not be shy with the ideas about leading, and also take their part and step up and raise their hand, because most times the answers lie in other people, not necessarily in the person who has the leadership role.
That's amazing. I like that open leadership. What inspired you to come to that approach?
Several things. When I was younger in these leadership roles, I think there's a bit of a hype on one's abilities and self-belief. And so you sort of tend to be a bit more arrogant, if I could use that word. But you're also trying to assert yourself. You're also trying to show people. My first leadership role in a corporate setting came from being part of a sales team and being picked from that sales team to lead that sales team. This is one of the most challenging things I've ever had to do, because all of a sudden I was being asked to lead my peers and people that I was working with, and having to give them direction and sort of like be tough with them when they didn't do things that were supposed to be done. And you'd get people accusing you of, yeah, now you're on management side, you're not seeing things our way and that kind of stuff. And so I had a great leader then who encouraged me to really step out of that team mentality and into the leadership space. And so that meant that I honed my skills a lot more and the arrogance disappeared. And so you start to realize that to lead your peers, you've got to get their buy-in, and you've got to, you know, sort of like work with them on issues that you want to lead them on. And the co-leadership thing started there, where I can't lead alone, guys, help me with this decision kind of thing. And so as you progress with that, you grow from leading people that directly report to you and are just people who rely on you, to then get to a point where you're leading other leaders. And so when you're leading other leaders, you can't have the same approach you have with when you're leading people who look up to you. And so leading leaders makes you collaborative. And that brings out the openness that has really shaped my leadership journey now. And I think that is something I'm really grateful for.
So in your open leadership style, what are some of the traits that have made you successful in leading that way?
Listening. I think that probably is the biggest one. It's the ability to just sit back and listen. And even when you know, or you think you know better than the person that is contributing to a certain subject that you're probably leading on, it's the ability to just hold on to your ideas and listen. And I've become a good listener by actively practicing listening. I wasn't that way before. And I would be the first to say, and those who know me will tell you, I tend to be dominant in discussions. I tend to then, because of that dominance, lead people in a certain way with the thinking, which is not a problem, but it could be a problem, because then it's always your ideas. And if the day you don't have ideas, then people don't move, if you know what I mean. And so for me, it's really critical that you listen. And I think that's one of the traits that I've become very strong in. And number two is two aspects that I practice, and I practice this religiously, and I have to keep reminding myself. And the first one is to assume positive intent. So when you lead, people will challenge you. People will give you ideas that are similar to yours. A lot of people will be political and just support you because you are the leader. And those kind of people don't really help you. But when you're being challenged, it's very important as a leader in my world to assume positive intent, to assume this person challenging you wants the best out of this situation, wants the best out of this discussion they're having with you that is raising this challenge. And when you do that, you always look at things positively, and you always see the other person's view to say, this one is not just challenging me for the sake of challenging me. There's a positive thing underlying that challenge. that is going to make the decision we make together as a team better. So that's the first principle. The second principle is to suspend judgment. When people say to you things that may not be pleasing to your ears and may not be aligned to your principles or your way of thinking in a certain way, is to suspend judgment until they finish. Just listen to them and say, and if you're not sure or clear, ask clarifying questions about what they're saying to understand why they're saying that. And then, if you can, only then would you then judge whatever they're saying. But in most cases, judgment is irrelevant anyway, because if you collaborate well, you'll arrive at a position that is mutual in consideration. And so that really, you can't practice those things if you're not open.
So true. If you're not open, what are the hindrances of being open?
You could be perceived to be weak because you're always listening. And, you know, in teams, you have people who are destructive. There are people who will just talk because they love their voices and they don't necessarily are contributing to anything. And they are time wasters. And everybody in the team will see their time wasters. And so, you know, but if you're listening to everybody in with equal measure, you can't dismiss those guys. You have to listen to them as well. And if they are dominant in number in your team and you keep listening to what they're saying, even if you're not agreeing with what they're saying or making decisions that agree with what they're suggesting, you could be seen to be a weak leader. And so you've got to be very cognizant of that. You have to sit back and know how to manage that particular situation where there could be challenges from your team or accusations of weakness. The other issue with openness is to what extent do you allow discussion, for example, or ideation or decision making before you make a stance and you say, okay, guys, I've heard all of you and this is what we're going to do. And it could lead to indecision, and indecision is a counter productive aspect of leadership, of effective leadership. If you're not decisive, I don't believe you could be a good leader. And so those are two things you have to worry about. On top of the fact that you could open yourself to ridicule, to unnecessary challenge, you could open yourself to, you know, just people not respecting you because openness could be perceived as a weakness as well. So you've got to do that balance of how are you open, but still firm. And it's not an easy balance to achieve, but it's possible.
Personally, for you, have you gotten that balance?
No, there's no lack of clarity about my family. Everybody who works with me knows that openness is given to everybody as a privilege of helping me to work and be better at what I do. And if you're not achieving that, then I'm very firm in saying, hey, where you're taking this discussion is not exactly where I'd like it to go. Yes, I'm allowing you to give me your views, but they have to be constructive views, whether they are, you know, views challenging mine or adding on to mine. They've got to be constructive. They've got to move us from this point to the next point. I do not want an argument. I want a discussion. So when I say something and then you say something, I'll come up and say something that builds on what you've said. And then your next contribution must also build on what I've said. If you stick on what you've said and I stick on what I've said, we're going nowhere. It just becomes an argument. And so I'm very, very quick to pick those out and to point them out and to call them out, because then you avoid time wasting. You also avoid the absence of clarity in driving that discussion, in driving the decision that you want to make. So that firmness then gets known as people work with you. They know to what extent they can push their openness that you allow them, and they know to what extent they're going to be clapped back if they go over that line.
Who or what has influenced you to take that approach?
Several leadership styles that I follow and leaders that I've studied across different spectra of life. I'm a career corporate person, and you'd expect that a lot of my leadership mantra and examples and teachings come from the corporate space. And that's true, but not entirely. I talked about my folks earlier, my dad's influence in my life at a very early age. I was in my early 20s when he died. My mom's continuing influence to date in what I do and who I am. The role of family in my sphere, especially the role of women in that sphere, because I've had a bigger influence from female figures in my life than I've had from male figures. And so that has taught me a very different view of life, if I could use that. And so there's that family side. And then there is, I'm not a person who follows politicians or likes politics for that matter, but I've had two or three political leaders that I've really admired, some of whom I've met personally. Nelson Mandela was one. And, just his, I think he came into the visible leadership role very late in his life when he became president of South Africa, but he'd been leading from his 20s when he was leading the revolution and resistance to the apartheid movement in South Africa. But what we then saw as young people in comparison to his age was this very well-polished, amenable, soft human being. If you were in his private presence, he was anything but that. He was a very firm leader, and he wouldn't allow you to go off tangents when he had a discussion with you on a particular matter. And that was admirable for me for the few occasions I was in his presence, seeing him do that with the people around him. I saw Barack Obama, never met him, but saw him a few times, attended conferences where he was addressing political caucuses. And you could see there are certain things that he endeared himself to the crowds with, and there are certain things that he just wasn't going to go there, and he was very clear about. And so that taught me that even though you're open, you've got to be firm. You've got to have trade-offs, and trade-offs are things that you will simply not do, or your values will simply not break. And so I think those are very good examples. And then in the corporate space, I have had many leaders, male and female, good and bad. I've learned from all of them. Strong and weak, strategic and operational, all sorts of leaders. And you pick up something, even those that really don't lead you well, there's an aspect of that style that pick up something. Sometimes it's how not to do things. Sometimes it's a leader whose 90% attributes are not good, but there's that 10% that you can pick and then add on to your repertoire so that when you then get that situation, you know how to deal with it. And so it's been a conglomeration of many influences from different angles of life.
What is one of your most memorable leadership experience that motivates you?
Yeah, so one of those styles of leading is that leading in the middle, leading with people. So I remember I talked about being the outright leader in certain situations, leading with other leaders in other situations, and then in the last set of situations, standing back and letting other people lead you. In that second set of situations where you're leading with people, I had an experience when I lived in Cape Town and worked for Pfizer, where, being part of a co-leading team, I had a boss who delegated the authority to me to lead a team of peers in his absence. One of the most character-building things you can do, because this is sort of like directors, and now you're sitting amongst them. You're one of them, and the area president is not around, and say, "Hey, Martin, step in for me and run this session for me." And he used to sit at the head of the table, and so sort of like had a domineering presence in the room. And I walked in, and if he delegated his authority to you, naturally you'd sit at the head of the table and do the same things. But I'd watched the body language we had when he was sitting at the head of the table and the way we were deliberating issues. And I didn't think, and I never told him this, but I didn't think he was getting the best out of us, because he was on a pedestal and we were sort of like a level below him in these discussions. And so when I walked into that delegated role for that particular session, I chose not to sit at the head of the table. And everybody was like, "Hey, Martin, hey, you're the boss for today, sit there." And I just said, "No, I want to sit not in my usual space, but at the center." It was a long table on one side, at the center, where I had half the room on my left and half the room on my right. And so I had a same level view of issues that the whole team had. I didn't elevate myself by sitting at the head of the table. And I got outcomes out of that meeting that I never thought were possible. And when we presented those to my boss when he came back from his trip, he couldn't believe that you guys went this far, made these decisions, and you've started implementing. What happened in that meeting? And I never told him really, but to me, that made a difference. And since then, I resist sitting at the head of the table as a symbolic thing, but as a practical thing, when I'm leading with people, it's good to be at the same level and give them the same influence you've got and the same example you want to give, you'll get the best out of them.
Martin, has there been a situation where you felt like resigning and leaving the position?
Yeah, I've had several of those. And I've executed one. And now when I look back at the one that I executed, even that wasn't sudden. It was building. It was long coming. But I've been in situations where, I'm not in the right place. I'm not the right fit for this job. And I'm feeling like this organization doesn't have shared values with my values. I'll give you just two examples. When I was in Pfizer in my early days, I had a leader when I was still a territory manager. I was in charge of a certain part of the East African region, and a very important region because it was a growth driver for our business at the time. And it spanned across Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania. So it's sort of like the Western Kenya part, Eastern Uganda part, and the Northwestern Tanzania part, marketing our prescription medicines to doctors, pharmacies, nurses, and hospitals. And I had a team working with me, but I had a boss who I didn't feel was pulling his weight and was just sort of like a happy-go-lucky fellow who, got accolades when we succeeded and came down on us when we didn't. And so it was very challenging. And I just knew I couldn't work with him for long. And at the time, I thought the best thing to do is not to challenge the situation, but then to leave and go to another organization where I didn't have these challenges. Eventually, what happened is he left, and then I didn't have to leave anyway, but I was very close to leaving. So, and that was just because I didn't feel he was leading us at all. I wasn't inspired by him. He didn't give me any reason to feel like, even though I was in a good multinational organization, that I was making inroads into where I wanted my career to go. So that's the one example. The other one is when I went higher into these global organizations, as inevitably happens when you do your bit and you're noticed and you keep growing, is you end up in positions where you're very senior, and then you're elevated at the global level. And so you become a global leader in a global business. And you get to some positions that are not operational. They're high profile, they're very prestigious. When you speak, people listen, but you have very little influence in the operations and what drives the key things that matter in businesses, which culminate in profit. And so you almost sit at head office somewhere in New York and you're just, dishing out emails and making calls to disturb markets about sending you reports and stuff like that. And I found that very hollow. I was in a job like that. And I said to my boss, I walked to my boss and I said, hey, I'm going to go back to Cape Town in the next 6 weeks, either to my old job or to another job where I can make a difference. I don't like this job where I sit here and I have this big title, but I have no influence on what's going on to help the business achieve what it needs to achieve. Luckily, it wasn't a threat, it was a discussion, but it culminated in me being redesigned back into operational roles, which is what I really enjoyed. And so that was driven by the frustration of having a big title, a big job, but doing nothing really. And so there are the occasions where, certain things drive you. You have co-leaders or peers that are not aligned or, are fighting instead of uniting to pull in the same direction. There've been other considerations where I felt like I should resign. I never really took them. Then there's one that I took in 2014 and left to take a sabbatical because my job had become way too hectic from a travel schedule perspective, not being home, and my life was suffering in all aspects. And I just felt like this was not tenable. And I eventually actually left at the end of that year with the aim of staying out for at least 1 year to then sort of like recoup before I could decide what to do. That 1 year became 2 months and I was back into things with some other business. But I left initially from that global business. So yeah, there are things that could frustrate you. I think the older you get, the wiser you are. And so the more measured you are with your decisions, and those rash decisions you make when you're younger tend to be less. But if you look at today's generation, our kids don't have that patience. If they don't like something, they buzz off and they're gone. We tend to be a bit more patient. Our father's generation was even more patient. These guys worked in one job from when they started and left college to when they retired. And so times have really changed as well. And so, yeah, those considerations are there.
If a young leader would come to you, and I don't know if they do come to you and they
Yeah.
ask you, Martin, I've watched your life, I read about you, I've heard about you. What will it take for me to be where you are right now? I'm just starting off. What would be your advice to them?
You know, traditionally, that advice would entail following my story, as in do what I did naturally. I mean, that would be the easiest advice you'd give them. It's like, yeah, work hard. There's no replacement for working hard. You've got to be patient. You've got to put in the time. I don't think that's relevant for this generation, to be honest. I don't think that formula works anymore, to be honest, as well. And I'll give you a bit of a tangential example. When I was in school, I don't know about you, George, you look like, you know, you went to school maybe a bit ahead of me. But when I was in school in the 80s, there was this philosophy of, you know, work hard, get good grades, get into college, be top of your class, graduate top of your class, get out, get a safe, secure job where you've got benefits, work there and wait for retirement. Such nonsense. But that was what our folks had gone through, and it was successful to them to a certain extent, but majorly it didn't really work for them if you look at their lives. And so some of us challenged that thing of, you know, safe, secure job for life with benefits. And so whereas they stayed in one job for their lifetime, we started the practice of looking for better things because we just believed we are growing, and part of growing is going elsewhere to then drive that growth. This generation behind us don't have the time that even we had. So if you advise them along the lines that you took, you're going to lose them. And so my advice to and I have a daughter who's 27 now, and she's in the corporate space, corporate legal space. And she asks me this question regularly because she's got this instant gratification need, and she's given a task over, say, a period of 18 months, and she feels she's done that task satisfactorily, she expects to then move in a promotion or something like that. She's 27. And I'm saying to her, when I was your age, I was just happy to have a job. You wanting to be what, a director now? And if you don't satisfy that, they will move to something else that gives them something closer to what they're looking for. And so I think the advice should be very different, is be happy. I would say to them, first of all, seek happiness in what you do. Because a lot of people are in jobs that make them sad, they are unhappy about bosses that, you know, annoy them at work, and they go home and kick the cat or the dog or something in frustration, when in actual sense, they could do something about that job. And so this generation is so focused on themselves that they don't take these positions so seriously. And so if they are unhappy, they move on. So happiness for me is one thing. Number two is make a difference. Make a difference in the everyday job you've got. And so, you know, don't go to work as a routine. When you get back home in the evening, look at yourself in the mirror. Do you like what you see? Are you happy about your contribution that day to that job, to that organization, to your department, to the country and to the world? Have you contributed something? And if you can't answer affirmatively to that question, there's a problem with that job. But the biggest advice I give people, and I do this regularly because our organizations are awash with young people who are coming up, looking at us and wanting to be where we are, but not realizing it took us 35 years to get here. And they want to know how it can be accelerated, forgetting you didn't accelerate yours. It took you time. But the advice I then say is be excellent at the job you have today. If you want to be promoted, if you want to grow quickly, do what you're doing today so well that the people who look at you, the people who manage you, have no choice but to give you more to do. And that more to do will then lead into growth and into promotion and into leadership roles. Inevitably, those roles will supersede the extent of your current team, and you'll be asked to do more, and you'll be asked to lead bigger teams. And, you know, the world has become so small that if you're in a global organization, you'll go to another market, a bigger market where you lead bigger teams. And one day you'll end up in New York as a global leader of a multinational business. Do what you've been given today Excellently. I can't be looking to give you more work as your leader if what I already gave you is not being done to the best of your ability. So if you want me to give you more responsibility, show me how good you are with what I've given you to do. And that to me is the only advice I would say to a young person. Then the time element is irrelevant. Because if you do that well, you're constantly being promoted. I grew in organizations where I worked in every second or third year, I had a different role. I didn't ask for those roles. I did somehow inadvertently because of the work that I was doing. And that's where this advice comes from, is just being good at what you do. Do it well. Commit to it fully. Somebody is going to notice that and then give you what you need to be given. And the other advice is a lot of these young generations that are behind us are driven by the material success they see in some of the people who occupy these positions that they admire. You know, the big car you drive, the nice suburb you live in, the sort of like top salary you do get. But that in itself is not a goal. That is a, you know, to me is a side effect of the work that you do. Those, the money and what the money can buy you follows the job. So you've got to look for the opportunities, do the job. And even if it doesn't pay you what you feel you're worth at the time, do it anyway and do it excellently. The money always follows.
So true. The money always follows. If you had to use a symbol or a metaphor of your kind of leadership, what would that look like?
I would use an animal. I'd use two animals because I remember I was talking about situational leadership earlier. And so in those different situations, I'm a very different person. So first of all, my professional sphere and my personal sphere are two completely different worlds. If you meet me at work and you spend a week with me and then you spend 2 days over the weekend with me, you'd probably be excused for thinking these are two different people, because that's exactly who I am. And so I have the ability to switch from this space to that space. And when I'm in this space, I'm completely devoid of considerations of things in this other space. So when I'm at work, I am at work. When I go home, I'm at home, and that's it. And so that ability allows me to be, I think if you asked me, I would say I'm good at those situational leadership changes and leading different situations with different approaches. And so the animals I would use is, the first one I would use is an elephant. And not because it's a big animal, but because of its ability to be calm in very difficult situations. One, knowing its ability to then address those situations if it needs to address those situations. I mean, if you're taunting an elephant and it's just looking at you, God forbid you taunt it to the point where it gets annoyed, because then it's going to crush you. And I'm not saying that we crush people in these roles, but an elephant to me is an animal I've always felt because of its size. And that calmness in relation to that size is one that I admire. And I would describe a lot of the situations that I lead as myself being an elephant in there. But the one I really admire is a cheetah. And for one reason and one reason only, not because of the spots or the stripes it has on its skin, but because of the fact that it shows no fear, even when it's most afraid. So I don't know if you know this, but cheetahs are very funny animals. You know, if you encounter a cheetah, if you just were walking somewhere and you just rocked up and a cheetah rocked up on the other side, you'd be scared out of your clothes and wanted to run. The cheetah is equally scared. It's like, okay, who's this? And why is he here? And whereas on your face, the fear would show, you'd never see it on the cheetah's demeanor. But inside, it's pumping with that fear. And so when it realizes that your fear is greater than its fear, and then it gains the confidence and would attack you if it needs to attack you to protect itself. And that's a leadership style I've always enjoyed, is when you're afraid, don't show it. When you're bubbling inside, don't show it, because people who follow you read what they see, not necessarily what's going on inside. And if your facade is one of calmness and one of confidence, they draw confidence from that. You can go home and cry about the situation because it made you feel that way, but you can't cry in front of people you lead at that particular time. And so those two animals really are admirable for me.
Well said and well captured. Thank you for that description. Having worked quite a bit outside Kenya and globally and part of Africa, and even right now your business is really a global business. And looking the place of Africa in this global ecosystem, what kind of leadership do we really need and this is in general terms, within our continent to fully achieve the best of ourselves as Africans?
It's a very broad subject, George. You know, it's somehow a frustrating subject as well, because the continent has so much potential. And in actual sense, the continent has been leading for generations, for centuries, for millennia, you could even argue. If you think about, you know, the origin of education, even the claimed origin of humanity itself, if you think about the early universities in places like Timbuktu, and if you think about early civilization in Egypt, we've always been at the forefront of global concepts, and that's not new. What's frustrating is that we seem to, at some stage in the 20th century, have taken a backseat towards this. And I think it is a direct remnant of the colonial mindset, where when we got our independence, we felt that these colonial masters were better than us, and so we needed to keep opening our hands for handouts from them. And so it debilitated our ability to just think for ourselves, when in actual sense, we had very good leadership systems in the old African setups before colonization. And so what frustrates me today is, if you look at our general leadership, and I'm talking politics and otherwise, it's wanting. And it's wanting in the, and it's wanting across the whole continent. Every now and then we get a luminary somewhere, Jerry Rawlings in Ghana. You get a Nelson Mandela who ruled for one term in South Africa. Somebody here and there who does something that is noticeable, but it is not systemic. So when they are gone, it goes with them. And that's really frustrating. The current space, Africa has 60% of the world's growing population. The youth, in terms of technology, in terms of the ability, in terms of potential to drive aspects that are global, sits in Africa. Africa has also about 60% of the world's natural resources needed for tomorrow's solutions for today's problems. Africa has the world's most arable land, the world's best climate, the world's best almost everything. Yet we are this continent that is sitting at the tail end of every discussion, being seen as the dark continent, and we've allowed that to go on for way too long. And I think what we do need in African leadership now, from African leaders, is a very strong voice to say no to that narrative, say no to the painting of the continent as a dark place that knows nothing and, you know, can't do anything for themselves. The resistance that we need to have towards borrowing for the sake of borrowing, to do things that we can do without borrowing, you know, an education system that is relevant for us, not just, you know, driven down to us from the West because of some alignment, some colonial master that we do have. And there's nothing wrong with the Western world, George, don't get me wrong. I mean, it's a different civilization, different culture, different approach to life. But I think Africa for Africans and African decisions for the African continent is what we need now. And we do need bold leadership in saying, this is the way we are going to go. And if we're going to go this way, these are the trade-offs we will have. We will not listen to this. We will not borrow with these conditions. We will not lead this way. We will deal with things that are stopping us from development, like corruption, for example. I mean, if you think about the whole issue of sustainability, which has become a very strong aspect of business leadership now, which better corporates do we have in the world than African ones to lead in this? We have the resources. But if you look at the African corporates that are looking to do this, like climate action, if I could just narrow down to that, for example, we sit here and say, hey, we need funding from the West to, you know, change our energy source to green sources. Really? When we have the sun shining here 24/7, we have the resources to buy solar panels and make the whole country solar. Why do we need people to fund us with these things? So there's that mentality. And I think it's just a legacy of colonial aspects that we are yet to shelve. And if we can do that, we are really poised to be, you know, the growth driver of global aspects going forward.
Wow, so true. And I always enjoy just hearing, as I keep talking to leaders, just the aspect of what we need to do in Africa. And thank you for sharing that. Just circling back, you know, to your current role and responsibility. And I must say, just hearing that Sasini PLC is really taking things to the global world, the agricultural products. And I think just commending you for that, because one of the things that we need to push very much, as you said, We have got good land, we've got good soil, we've got good weather. You know, we can be the food basket of the world, and you are already shaping that. So for people who are thinking about really taking agriculture business to the next stage, or people talking about agriculture and the way, you know, there are these voices encouraging us to do that, what would be your contribution to that in encouraging people to do that and to step out?
The reality, George, is that our economy has been backboned on agriculture for long. I think 60% of our GDP is agriculturally driven. Just to give you a few stats, tea, for example, which is Sassini's biggest business, contributes about 8% of that GDP as a crop, a single crop on its own. And tea also, as a single crop, brings in 25% of our foreign exchange. So all the forex you see in this country, a quarter of it is sourced from the selling of our tea. Such a critical part of our economy, and by extension, coffee, macadamia, avocado, sugar, whatever we grow, French beans, vegetables, flowers, if you, that's all agriculture. And so that, you know, we've moved from, if you understand global change and eras of development, somebody could look at Kenya and say, you're still in the agrarian age. And so people have moved to, one, the technology age, and now in the data age, information age, why still sticking in this production of primary goods? But that's what we are good at. And the world needs that. There's no way, whether even the day we get to robotic human beings, they will need to eat. And so as long as they need to eat, there'll be the need somewhere to grow this food. And so you can't completely run away from agriculture or the growing of food to feed masses in the world. And you can see how the global population is growing. And so we are good at this. And we have cash crops that are globally known. Kenya is the biggest exporter of black tea. I'll say that again slowly. Kenya is the biggest exporter of black tea. We are the third largest grower of tea in the world, after China and India. China produces about 2 billion kilos of tea. It's mainly green tea, and it's all drunk in China. India produces about 1.4 billion kilos of black tea. It's mainly drunk in India. Kenya produces 600 million kilos of black tea. 96% of that is exported to the world. And so if you're drinking black tea anywhere in the world, that blend has Kenyan tea somehow. And so we are very proud of that. And it's a very good thing to be proud about. If you think then, by way of extrapolation, all these other crops that we are growing and that we are good at and making primary produce out of and trying, as the government is driving now, to go up that value chain with value addition so that we can export finished products. What better way than to use the resources we've got in areas we're already strong, agriculture. And so I would encourage anybody who's willing to go into that space to not hesitate. Here's the problem, George. And I'm sure you've gone through this reasoning at some stage in your life. Agriculture is seen as one of those things you do when you fail at everything else. So you're looking for a job and you don't get a job, and you get a job you don't like. At some stage in your mid-30s, your dad says to you, hey, come on, man, why are you struggling in Nairobi? There's 2 acres here at home. Come and grow sugarcane and maybe you can make some money out of it. So it's a last resort. When in actual sense, if he had held you from college on those 2 acres to start sugarcane when you are 25, 10 years before you get frustrated in a job somewhere in Nairobi, you'd be so far ahead. And so we have to change the mindset from our young generation away from the fact that this is not a mainstream career or money-making thing to do. Agriculture has money, I can tell you from Sassini's perspective, very profitable. And done well, does change a lot of lives. And Kenya's agriculture, Sassini is a large-scale grower of all these crops. So, you know, we contribute in each of those crops as part of the large-scale growers of the country, about 40% of each of those crops. The rest of it, 60%, is in small-scale farmers. You and I on half an acre, 1 acre, 3/4 of an acre here and there. Those small-scale farmers are people like you and I. And so if we're not encouraging our kids to then take up this growing of crops in a small scale that conglomerates and aggregates into big volumes for production, including production in companies like Sassini, who then is going to take over these jobs or these roles? And so I'm very encouraging about people wanting to go in agriculture. And it the way it's done today, there's a lot of smart ways to do agriculture. You don't have to do it the way our great grandfathers did it. There's artificial, intelligent ways of regenerative agriculture, for example. But you can't conduct an agricultural business remotely. And so just like you can't work remotely in all jobs, there's some jobs you can't do remotely. You can't pick tea working from home. It's just not doable. And so you've got to be able to roll up your sleeves and be on the ground and do what agriculture demands that you do to be successful. It's a very, very, very lucrative career, if you ask me.
Well, thanks, Martin. Quite inspiring to hear that about agriculture. And I concur with you and believe what you have said. Your final comments before we say goodbye.
You know, it's such a broad subject that it's very difficult to find one true answer of what leadership is. I'm sure in this series of podcasts that you do, when you ask people what is leadership or what does leadership mean to you, you get such an array of answers that you probably listen to this back and you think to yourself, so what is this thing? Because different people have different views of it. Some of our views are formed from listening to other leaders. Some of those views are formed from seeing what other leaders do. Some of those views are formed from our own experiences, the way we've been led and the way we are now leading and seeing where we succeed and where we fail. And some of those views are accidental. You just encounter things that you have to lead. You've never encountered that issue before, and now you have to deal with it. And so it teaches you something. My summary of it would be the best form of leadership is where you listen. Because it's in other people's ideas that you get inspiration. And so there are four types of leadership or four areas of leadership that are important for me to be a successful leader. On top of having the listening skills, having the situational leadership skills, one is self-leadership. How do I lead myself? What do I do when I'm alone? How do I speak to myself? What language do I use to speak to myself when I am speaking to myself? Because I do that. And I'm not crazy. It's just the way things are. And then the second aspect is people leadership. And I can't lead people if I can't lead myself. So self-leadership is really important. And then I can take those positive aspects into leading people in what you call people leadership area. And then when I'm successful with that is thought leadership. And thought leadership is not really about generation of good ideas. It is that, but it's also how you get other people to help you with those good ideas, how you inspire other people to then bring those good ideas to the table. Being a thought leader, being one who breaks ground and breaks the ceilings to open new grounds for people. If you do those three things well, you get the last aspect of leadership, which is results leadership. The results follow you. So you have to lead yourself before you lead the people, before you can go into the thought space, then you see results. If you do that well and consistently, it's actually a very easy job to do.
Wow, what a nice way of concluding. Thank you, Martin, so much. I've enjoyed having this conversation with you, and I believe every person eavesdropping to this conversation will be equally inspired and blessed. Thank you so much for your time and for all that you have shared with us. Wishing you success and victory in all that you do. Thank you, sir.
And thank you, George. Thanks for the time. Thanks for your humility as well. Thanks for according me this time. And feel free to call me if you have any other series that I can help your eavesdropping listeners to.
Okay.
I'll be glad to do that. Okay.
All right. Thank you, sir. And all the best.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us in today's podcast. We hope you're leaving with insights that will help you live and lead better. We appreciate our sponsors, BNG Consultants Limited and BNG Center for Leadership Coaching, for keeping us on air. Bye for now. See you in our next episode.